Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Every year brings an anniversary of an event in American history, some trivial, others seismic. 2018 marked a half century since a year that was full of seismic events, 1968. The whole world is watching was the chant coming from protesters who had gathered on the streets of Chicago during the 1968 Democratic Convention. The shocking sight of club-wielding police going after those protesters outside the convention hall while political fractures were on full view inside the hall mirrored divisions in the country. It was a polar opposite bookend to the optimism and hope that signaled the start of the 60s with the inauguration of President John F. Kennedy. In between, there were assassinations, civil rights marches, protests against the Vietnam War, and the sense that America was changing. That angst, anger, turbulence, and innocence lost was also reflected in our music.
Oh, where have you been, my blue-eyed son? And where have you been, my darling young one? I've stumbled on the side of 12 misty mountains. I've walked and I crawled on 6 crooked highways. I've stepped in the middle of 7 side forests. I've been out in front of a dozen dead oceans. I've been 10,000 miles in the mouth of a graveyard. And it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard rain you're gonna fall.
This remarkable decade has been summed up in Fry Gallyard's new book, A Hard Rain, America in the 1960s, Our Decade of Hope, Possibility, and Innocence Lost, which was published in August on the anniversary of the 1968 convention. He joined us by phone from his home in Alabama. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Mike. Good to be with you.
I should mention that you used to live and work here in Charlotte, worked for The Observer, and you've written more than 20 books on Southern culture and history. So why this focus now on the 1960s?
Well, it seemed to me, it's a subject that I kind of grew up with. I was a kid in middle school when the 60s began, and I graduated college just as the decade was coming to an end and began a career as a reporter in the last year of the 60s. So it was a formative time for me, and it always kind of shaped my view of the world, I think. So that's one reason. But it also seemed like some of the issues that we thought we had grappled with pretty effectively back in the 60s and maybe made some degree of change, that some of those issues were coming back around again. A few years ago, I was thinking about the backlash against President Obama, not just disagreement with his policies, but a backlash against him personally that I saw in Alabama and other places. And I was thinking, some of these racial issues that we thought we had made so much progress on are still with us. And so I began to think about it in that context, the connections between the 60s and the troubles we're living through now. And I just decided the time had come when I wanted to try to tell the story of that decade for whatever insight it might have for our own time.
I guess because the baby boomers came of age in the 1960s, and they were the largest segment of the population for a very long time until, I think, the millennials came along. We've done a lot of navel-gazing about our time on the planet. For those people who did not live through the 1960s and are going, would you please give it up, move on, or who may bemoan some of the things that came about because of what happened in the 1960s, how would you describe those years and what it was like to live through those years?
To me, as I looked back on it and tried to write about it, I realized that at the time I experienced it as kind of two stories in one. One of them was full of hope, the idea that we could make this a better country, a country that lived up to its ideals, its founding principles more fully perhaps than we ever had before. The civil rights movement kind of made you think that way. The John Kennedy's inaugural address, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. Things like the Peace Corps, they were such pure expressions of American idealism, and there was just that hopeful quality in the air that stayed there most of the decade, but it was soon joined by other things. It was joined by something darker. Violence became one of the themes of the decade, too, and backlash and political division and all of those things. So for me, it was, I don't want to say it was a schizophrenic time, but it was like there were two sides of our national character being exposed. I mean, it's more complex than that, but there were at least two broad themes, one of hope and one of something much, much darker. It was also just a time where possibilities seemed so open-ended, and so many things were being thought about and experimented with. You know, it was not only the civil rights movement, it was soon the women's movement, and then by the end of the decade, the environmental movement, and there were even some stirrings with regard to gay rights, and Ralph Nader came along in 1966 and launched what was considered to be the consumer rights movement. The U.S. Supreme Court issued lots of decisions expanding the rights of defendants in court. And so people asserting their rights, asserting their identity, asserting their right to full participation in American life, all of those things were happening. And then you had the sub-themes of music and art and movies and all of that. So I experienced it as a really rich time. And I wanted to try to give younger readers who didn't live through it just a sense of not only what happened, but how it felt when it did.
Yeah. This theme of this yin and yang, if that's the
yes.
right term, this tug and pull of optimism versus skepticism, and how the decade began versus how the decade ended, and all of the things
right.
that went in between. As you say, it's a running theme in the decade. It's also a running theme in your book. And I was going to save this question till the end, but I'm going to ask it now.
Okay.
Which side won?
Well, that's a really good question. And you know, I thought at the time that the decade ended, I thought that the darker forces had won. I thought that Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King's assassinations, kind of those were our great apostles of hope, as late as 1968. And I thought with their deaths, it felt like to me that that all the things we had hoped for were just not going to happen. But as time went by, some of those ideals persisted. We continued, you and I were talking off the air about how in some ways the 60s continued into the 70s, and we had, some fairly hopeful things that happened. You know, Jimmy Carter being elected president, and although his presidency didn't work out as well as he had hoped, and some of us who voted for him had hoped, still, you know, he was trying to apply the lessons of civil rights to the whole idea of human rights in the world. And so some of those themes continued and continue to shape our lives. And I think it's been kind of it's an ongoing struggle that remains in some ways a toss-up. When the decade started, I was sure, as young people are sure, that things were going to change for the better, and we were living on the cusp of a whole new time. By the end of the decade, I was disillusioned, and now I guess I'm sort of somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, and that hope and optimism drove people for the better part of that decade, particularly young people. But then I do remember this crashing sense of loss and defeat when both Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King were assassinated, and Richard Nixon was elected, and the war didn't end right away like he promised it would. And
right.
you just began to feel like all this hope and optimism was misplaced and perhaps a product of being too naive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
what do you think?
Well, that's how it felt to me at the time. Like we should never have been so optimistic. The deck is stacked. The game is rigged. You know, the forces of the dark side of human nature is just too powerful. But you know, we were young, right? A lot of us. I mean, I'm a little bit older than you, but you know, I started the decade as a kid and ended it as a young reporter. And young people are not very patient, and so the things that you hope for passionately, if they don't happen on a young person's schedule, sometimes you grow bitter and disillusioned. And we
do you think that bitterness and that disillusionment that so many people felt, because this was the largest generation on the planet at the time,
right.
that impacted life in America, politics in America, thought in America, going forward into the next several decades? Did it have a lasting impact, that disillusionment?
I think it did. Yeah, I think it did. And I think it was easier to be disillusioned than it was to be hopeful when the decade ended. Mm. And I think we had to work at resurrecting the hope that defined the decade in the beginning. And fortunately, you know, you have people who try to help us do that. You know, for me, my politics are such that when President Obama was elected in 2008, I was very moved by the hopefulness of his campaign and very moved by the concept that America could elect an African-American president. I thought that was a measure of progress that would have been almost unthinkable in the 1960s. And so there were always people who tried to summon the best within us. I mean, on the conservative side of the political spectrum, I think figures like John McCain tried to do that. I mean, they were deeply principled, patriotic people, and so there were always people who pushed back against the disillusionment. But I think it became a reality in American life because of the things that happened in the 60s, and we're still dealing with that dark reality.
You've said that for you, and this is a quote, there was in these years the sense of a steady unfolding of time as if history were on a forced march and the changes spread to every corner of our lives. As I read that sentence, I thought that feels, although it was slower as it unfolded, it feels not unlike what we're going through now with the much more rapid unfolding of the news cycle. Do you see parallels there as well?
I do. It feels the times we're living in now, with the huge difference being the cable news cycle and the sort of immediacy of people finding out what's going on and the ability of the media to keep just going, you know, just almost beating a story to death at some point. And I think it's just inevitable if that's what happens. But so the way we cover the news is different. The way we receive it is different now. But the intensity of the news and the rapidness with which things happened seems to me to be very parallel. You know, one of the little episodes that I describe in the book, it was a tragic moment, but when Martin Luther King was killed in Memphis in April of 1968, Robert Kennedy was going to Indianapolis to give a speech in a black neighborhood. And if it were today, by the time he got there, everybody would have known that
right.
Martin Luther King had been killed. But it was a different day, and the news had not reached this crowd of several thousand African Americans who were waiting for him in the ghetto. And so Kennedy actually told them that Martin Luther King had been killed.
And let me stop you there, Fry, because we have to take a break. We'll come back to that story in just a moment. I think I know where you're going with it. Fry Gallyard with us on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're listening back to our August conversation with Southern historian and author Fry Gallyard. He is a former reporter and editor at the Charlotte Observer and is now the writer-in-residence at the University of South Alabama in Mobile. When he spoke with us, he had just published his latest book, A Hard Rain, America in the 1960s, Our Decade of Hope, Possibility, and Innocence Lost. It was a remarkable time which continues to shape this country today, with reverberations through our politics and our culture that will probably linger for the rest of the century, it seems. And you were talking before the break about one of the things that is kind of a parallel to this time, the sense that we were living through an unfolding series of historic events. And one of the things you were talking about was how slow the news cycle was then as compared to today, because when, as you said, when Martin Luther King was assassinated, Robert Kennedy was on his way to Indianapolis to do a rally, and he was going to one of the ghetto areas of Indianapolis, and he got there, and many people there, unlike today, didn't know what had happened in Memphis.
Yeah, it was, and so if you, there are tapes of this speech, and when he tells the crowd, you can hear this sort of moan and gasp and kind of collective scream of horror that goes up from the crowd as they hear it.
I have some very sad news for all of you, and I think sad news for all of our fellow citizens and people who love peace all over the world, and that is that Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis, Tennessee.
For me, it was a, I remember the night that Martin Luther King was killed. I was in my apartment with some friends, and we received that news with the same kind of disbelief that, you know, 5 years earlier we had received the news that the President of the United States had been killed. And riots erupted all over the country that night because it was just the last straw for many black Americans. Their great apostle of nonviolence had been violently murdered. And so it was just too much, and there was violence all over the country, except in Indianapolis, where Robert Kennedy had gone into that neighborhood. And he talked to the people about their sense of loss and about his own sense of loss.
And he had never spoken about his own sense of loss over his
death. No, he didn't
death.
Talk about it much. Yeah. But he wanted to make that connection, and he quoted the Greek poet Aeschylus about tragedy and pain falling drop by drop upon the human heart until in our against our will comes wisdom through the awful grace of God. I mean, he really reached back for this very for everything he could think of that would connect our experiences and try to pull people together.
He did that off the cuff. Let's talk about that for a second, because the 60s wasn't just about violence and anger and things like that. It was about poetry. How many politicians today could, off the top of their head, in an appropriate situation, quote Aeschylus? And he wasn't alone. And I think that poetry of the time filtered into music. It filtered into art. It filtered into motion pictures. What was it about the 60s that allowed that?
Yeah, it's really an amazing thing, isn't it? I mean, you saw it in the music. I mean, that's why I chose for the title of the book, a Bob Dylan reference, right? I mean, because Dylan was kind of one of the great poets of the decade. And from the very beginning, there were people who were trying to find the poetic expressions of the larger hopes that were going on, and that were there in the world in so many ways, and even like you said, many of our politicians were pretty poetic about this stuff. You know, John Kennedy's inaugural address was he didn't write it, though it reflected his and he did fiddle with it, and they, but it was a great poetic call to idealism. And the same, in Robert Kennedy's case, when his brother died, according to people who knew him, he sort of plunged into, in his despair, all kinds of, literature from classic days, and he read existentialist philosophers, and so his ability to reach into poetic illusions was it really came quite naturally to him, quite came from the heart. In the free speech movement in Berkeley in the mid 60s, there main spokesman, Mario Savio, was a philosophy major who quoted the ancient Greeks, extemporaneously in rallies when they would try to take over buildings and so forth. So there, it was very interesting juxtaposition with the passion that it was also often shaped by sort of philosophy and poetry. It seemed rooted in some kind of larger sense of purpose. Some of that came from the civil rights movement. The depth of understanding that Martin Luther King brought, that nonviolent philosophers like James Lawson, who taught nonviolent theories to the student sit-in folks. There was a kind of grounding that was both poetic and philosophical, and that was one of the moving aspects of the decade for me.
So let's talk about the why. Why the 60s were like what they were like. What do you think precipitated the changes? We came out, was it simply a new generation coming of age at a time coming out of the pent-up 1950s where everything was prim and proper, the arrival of a president and first lady that were the embodiment of Camelot and style and grace and fashion, who were then ripped from the stage because of an assassination? Was it that assassination? Was it the war in Vietnam that caused the 60s to be what we remember them as?
You know, Mike, I think as you're going through that, I think it was all of those things. I think it was the juxtaposition of so many things and why they came together at the time they did is, you know, one of the historical mysteries, I think. But the fact that you had the sort of promise of Camelot that the Kennedys embodied at the same time that you had young people in Greensboro and Charlotte starting a movement that became the sit-in movement. And they were such idealistic young people. You know, they dressed in their Sunday finest to go sit in at lunch counters. And they tried to make their dignity, stand in contrast to the ugliness of the people who, you know, attacked them or yelled insults at them. And so, those were profoundly idealistic images for the rest of us. And, you know, it spilled over, like you said, into music and into, you know, some of the movies that we saw during those times and some of the writings, you know. Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird came out in 1960. Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, where she sounded a warning about environmental devastation, but also raised the possibility that we could work together to save the planet. You know, that came out in 1962. So there were always these voices that were trying to call us to something better, to something more hopeful.
There have been lots of...
Why they all happened at the same time, I don't know. I think it's fascinating, and I don't have the answer to that in the
book. There've been lots of books, lots of documentaries, television shows about the 1960s, and I think what you have tried to do in this book to differentiate it from all the other books is not just be a chronological account of what happened when and by whom. It was to help, as you said earlier, to help people understand how it felt to live through those times. Of course, everybody who lived through those times had different feelings about different events. So this has to come from what you felt, I would take it. How do you express what you and your friends and your associates felt at that time? How do you write it in a way that helps people who didn't live through those times or who perhaps experienced it differently to actually understand what it felt like to have these events swirl around you, to watch society change from straight-laced to hippies and love and drugs, to experience what young men who had to sign up for the draft for a war they disagreed with were feeling? It's a lot to write about.
It is a lot to write about. There are times that it becomes a very personal history where I actually use the first-person pronoun. But those times are, I sort of sprinkle those sparingly through the book, only when I think it really adds some depth of insight into not just how I was feeling, but how others were feeling. For example, with the assassination of President Kennedy, I write about being a senior in high school and walking down the hallway between classes before there had been an official class change. I was on an errand for a teacher, and another kid I knew, who I knew to be sort of a prankster, a practical joker, was running down the hall, and he said, "Kennedy's been shot," and I just thought he was joking. The idea that, I thought it was a dark joke, but, you know, I tried to be hip and cool, and I said something flip in response, much to my searing embarrassment a few minutes later when I discovered that it was real. But it just didn't occur to me that that could really be the case. And then he stopped, and he looked at me in this very solemn, shocked way, and he said, no, really, he's been shot. And I remember running back to the office to see if the television was on. As I was going back, I thought, oh, I wonder where the bullet hit him. I bet it hit him in the arm or something. Oh my goodness, how terrible! But you know, I'm just so glad he'll be okay. I mean, it was that my mind was in kind of a racing denial of what the possibilities soon proved to be. And, you know, so that kind of personal moment is there a few times in the book. I also tried to interview people in a very personal way about things that they experienced that I didn't. For example, I did not go and fight in Vietnam, and I interviewed some people who did. One guy that I talked to at great length, it was one of the most moving interviews I've ever done, a guy named John Slattery, who was a Marine in Vietnam. And he talked about going out on patrol one night and killing a Viet Cong soldier. And he went up to look at the body, and it was a child about 12 years old who was, in fact, a Viet Cong soldier, but he looked like a little boy. And this just about kill John, this tough Marine guy, and he developed drug problems and eventually was hospitalized with all kinds of post-traumatic stress, mental disorders, and he thought, I'm supposed to be a tough Marine, I shouldn't be torn up about this, but he was. And, you know, so I let some other people tell their stories about how it felt, and then, of course, find those same stories in newspapers. And, you know, it was a pretty exhaustive kind of 3-year project of research to pull it all together. But it is a lot my perceptions, but it isn't just my perceptions, because, as you said, so many people experience pieces of the decade in different ways.
Every decade has its highs and lows, but this decade, and I don't think I'm exaggerating, seemed to have extreme highs and extreme lows. I mean, we begin the decade with the election of John Kennedy. He's young, he's full of vigor, to use his own words. He has soaring rhetoric, even when he opens his mouth to ad-lib at a press conference. In your preface, you quote the words of President Kennedy talking about the nation being summoned to bear the burden of the long twilight struggle against the common enemies of man, tyranny, poverty, disease, and war itself. It was a call to action for young people and Americans everywhere. It set the tone for the decade. And so when you set the tone for the decade in that way and things go so horribly wrong as the decade goes on, is that what caused, do you think, in part, these riots in the streets at Vietnam? Because the expectations had been set so high, and the reality was the exact opposite.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think the old phenomenon of rising expectations being potentially destabilizing was on steroids in the 60s, because there were so many people setting the expectations high. You know, Martin Luther King set the expectations high in a different way. Malcolm X set the expectations high. You know, Betty Friedan and Gloria Steinem as the women's movement began to take shape, set the expectations high. So there were huge expectations, and then, like you said, they were not met, or they were only partially met.
Yeah.
And even though some important things happened, civil rights legislation, the Voting Rights Act, and the South, the creation of the possibility of a multiracial democracy in the southern part of the United States. Those kind of things did happen, but it felt like at the time that they were being overshadowed by the things that weren't happening. You know, and as Martin Luther King's life was drawing to a close, he was aiming higher even than when he started. He was talking about the moral imperative to end poverty in America, to end income inequality in America, and of course that's where his movement hit the wall. I mean, he was not able, in the time he had left, to figure out how to approach that much more complex issue, and yet he did raise the expectations about it. And then he was killed.
Since 2001, this nation has lived in fear. We have been fighting a war on terror. We've been fighting the longest actual war in our history. We have hardened airports and other places because of the attacks of 9/11. But people who didn't live through the 60s probably don't understand that this was also, as you point out in the book, a nation living in fear back then. What you call the constant undertow of dread, of living in a Cold War, a competition between two countries armed to the teeth with nuclear weapons. But even then, outside of the Cuban Missile Crisis, when everybody was on edge for 7 days, do you think the average American thought a lot about that, or did they experience it because of the way the power structure responded to it through their decisions to always fight against communism? That's why we were in Vietnam, after all.
That's right. Yeah, I think that it was talked about so much, all through the 1950s too. I mean, that was when that sort of sense of Cold War began to really take shape, and it was scary. I mean, to be a kid and you have these ridiculous drills where, in case of a nuclear attack, you hide under your desk. You know, I mean, we all did that, and maybe we thought about how absurd that was, or maybe we didn't, but we were aware that adults were telling us that we could blow up.
We have to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about one of the defining parts of the 1960s, the war in Vietnam. It was, the defining thing. Maybe you could take issue with me when we come back. Fry Gallard is with us, the author of A Hard Rain, America in the 1960s, Our Lost Decade of Hope, Possibility, and Innocence Lost. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
WFAE wants to bring your podcast to life. Submit your story or idea to WFAE's Queen City PodQuest, a contest to find the next great podcast in the Charlotte area. Learn more at wfae.org/Queen City PodQuest.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Back to our August conversation with Fry Gallard, historian and author. His latest book is A Hard Rain, America in the 1960s, Our Decade of Hope, Possibility, and Innocence Lost. Before we talk about Vietnam, let me talk about one more thing. Some of the issues that we dealt with and which sprang to life in the 60s are still with us today. And you quote Robert Kennedy, who was running for president in 1968, speaking at your alma mater, Vanderbilt, about the millions of Americans who were suffering from Mississippi to Indian reservations to Appalachia. And he said, quote, "I have seen proud men in the hills of Appalachia who wish only to work in dignity, but the mines are closed and the jobs are gone, and no one, neither industry or labor or government, has cared enough to help." Donald Trump could have said those exact words. Has nobody addressed this problem in 48 years?
It really is amazing, isn't it, how strikingly similar some of those issues are. I suppose you could say there's a systemic issue with regard to power obtained by coal. I mean, there are the environmental concerns, there are the safety concerns, there are the just the question of whether that's the most efficient way to get energy, and other things come along with this. But for half a century, people in the coal fields have had a sense of their way of life, of their economy, of shrinking and nobody really caring. John Kennedy won West Virginia in 1960. It was a place that where he sort of proved that a Catholic could communicate with a overwhelmingly Protestant electorate, and he was able to break through because he cared about the economic deprivations that people were facing in the coal fields. And yet, like you said, here we are. And Donald Trump, reached out in a maybe a more angry sounding way, but still was trying to reach out in terms of the same grievance.
Well, after 50 years, one would think anger would have built, even though Donald Trump has never experienced that himself.
Absolutely. And so you can understand, I think, some of the reason that somebody who at least seemed to care would might get some of those votes.
Before the break, I said we were going to talk about what I think was the defining, it's not a moment, it's not even an event, but the defining thing of the 1960s, for lack of a better word. I'm not very eloquent today. And that would be Vietnam. Would you agree that that was the defining characteristic of the 1960s?
I would. I think there was nothing more important and nothing more tragic. I think it was the defining tragedy of the times, that's for sure. It was a... and that's kind of how I write about it in the book. There were people who talked about it being an immoral war. Or there were people who talked about it being, an act of patriotism. And different people experienced that in different ways. But to me, what it was for sure was a tragedy.
Yeah.
Because the United States saw the things that were going on in Southeast Asia through the lens of Cold War Europe. There was this sense of communist expansion driven by the Soviet Empire. And because, at least rhetorically and sometimes financially, the Soviet Union did support liberation movements, as some people call them, in various parts of the world. And because Ho Chi Minh, the North Vietnamese head of state, was in fact a member of the Communist Party, it became easy to overlook from the American perspective that the resistance, that the uprising in Vietnam was also partly non-communist as well. There were Buddhists and there were others who made common cause. And so from the perspective of people living there, the question was whether the United States would become the heir to France and other imperialist powers who had controlled Vietnam. And so it was like people, it was like our perceptions were so at odds that this war began to escalate, and we couldn't find a way to even talk about it because we just saw it in such tragically different ways. And then American young men and Vietnamese peasants paid an awful price for the leaders on both sides who couldn't figure out how to talk to each other.
It divided families because you had the sons of World War II veterans who had gone to that war and fought valiantly and saved the world, essentially.
That's right.
Sitting at dinner tables arguing with their fathers about not wanting to go to Vietnam because the war made no difference. It was an immoral war, as you said, and it made the country divided. Politics today is described as the most divisive it has been since the Civil War. But the politics of the 1960s, particularly beginning in about 1964 or so, was also divisive. You have these young people in the streets marching for civil rights, protesting the Vietnam War. That leads to a sitting president deciding not to stand for re-election. It leads to a presidential campaign in 1968 marked by the assassination of a candidate who looked like he might pull out the nomination. It led to rioting in the streets of Chicago during the Democratic Convention and divided delegates on the floor. And here's Connecticut Senator Abraham Ribicoff speaking at that convention.
And with George McGovern as president of the United States, we wouldn't have to have Gestapo tactics in the streets of Chicago. how hard it is, how hard it is to accept the truth.
He's being booed on the floor of the convention. That's back when political conventions on television were something to watch because you never knew what was going to happen. But
never knew.
That convention and what happened on the streets outside of that convention, I don't even know how to describe it if you weren't there to see it. It was
just horrifying. And the bitterness and the anger, one of the things that doesn't show up on that tape is between those two things that Ribicoff said that you played, Mayor Daley of Chicago stood up and yelled an anti-Semitic slur at Ribicoff, and that prompted Ribicoff to say how hard it is to accept the truth. So that was the level of just anger and division. And one of the things that happened in the country was that some politicians decided that division was something to be exploited, while others desperately wanted to heal the division. You know, I thought Robert Kennedy's campaign was about healing divisions, but George Wallace was about exploiting divisions. And Richard Nixon picked up on some of that with his Southern strategy. And one of Nixon's advisors, Kevin Phillips, wrote that politics is about who hates who. So, you know, the divisions were there, and some people decided the political future, the way to get what you want is to try to make them worse. And you had cultural figures who tried to do the opposite. You know, I sometimes tell people that my politics were shaped by Robert Kennedy and Johnny Cash, because you had Johnny Cash on his television show in 1969, bringing in musicians who identified with different parts of the political spectrum to try to make the statement that the things we have in common go deeper than the things that divide us. But that was an uphill sales pitch that Cash and those politicians had to make in those bitter times.
Well, you have this election season in 1968 that started out, although it was started out with the decision by Lyndon Johnson not to run again, that opened up possibilities. Eugene McCarthy was running. Robert Kennedy gets into the race. George McGovern takes his place. But Hubert Humphrey becomes the ultimate nominee, the establishment candidate, the man who had been vice president to the man who's perpetuating this war in Vietnam. So you have that, the expectations and the bitter defeat. Then you have Republicans in 1968 who have been in the wilderness for a while. The 64 campaign was a disaster for Barry Goldwater. The GOP held only a third of the seats in the Senate, the fewest seats in the House at any time since the New Deal. They had only 17 governorships in the country, yet Richard Nixon beat Vice President Humphrey. Richard Nixon, the guy who was defeated by the man from Camelot in 1960, 8 years later, this much darker political figure wins the election. Another turn of events, another odd juxtaposition, another high versus low. What was the impact of Richard Nixon's election on the Times?
You know, Richard Goodwin, who had been a speechwriter for Robert Kennedy and for Lyndon Johnson as well, said he wrote at the time, "Richard Nixon has won. The 1960s are over." A friend of mine, John Siegenthaler, who was the editor of the Nashville Tennessean and had been a very close friend of Robert Kennedy, said to me bitterly after Nixon was elected, the country deserves Nixon because he was so angry that the assassinations of 1968 had happened. It was like the sense that a lot of us had was that our darker impulses had won with the election of Nixon, because there was something about him even then that you just had the sense that this was a deeply cynical, kind of paranoid man. And some of the things that came out in Watergate were things that we sensed in 1968 as he was running. A lot of us didn't believe that he had a plan to end the war in Vietnam, mm-hmm. and the war did, in fact, continue for years and years after that.
Do you see parallels to that politically today?
Well, I do. I think I think the depth of cynicism that Nixon brought to politics may have begun to change the DNA of our politics in a way. You know, Nixon was willing to have his surrogates try to undermine peace talks in about Vietnam, because he didn't want progress toward peace to occur just before the election, because he thought it would hurt his chances. That's a deeply cynical calculation. Now, I should say about Nixon that he also, you know, had a statesman side, too. I mean, he would later open up relations between the United States and China, which was important to world stability. An environmental protection agency started under Nixon. So I'm not trying to cast him as a one-dimensional villain, but there was something about him that that paved the way for some of the cynicism that I think we see in our politics today.
And yet, despite all these political ups and downs and the tumult over Vietnam and the marches for civil rights, etc., it was also a time of optimism. And I think that optimism lasted through the decade. I mean, this is the decade in which John Kennedy decided we were going to put men on the moon by the end of the decade. And by God, we did. This was the time of artistic achievement as well, particularly in music and film and in certain cases, theater. And all of this was woven into this tapestry that was this decade. The music of the 60s endures.
I think it does.
I don't know if the music of the 40s, which was certainly a part of the of World War II, endured as long as the music of the 60s has. Has it?
I don't know, but I think the music of the 60s is certainly, the Beatles are still a cultural icon, you know. In some ways, so is Elvis. We have the kind of cultural recollection of Woodstock. I mean, people know what that illusion has to do with. So, I think it's interesting that you brought up the space race. You know, there was the, we did put somebody on the moon in 1969. It was interesting that a juxtaposition even then of the double-sided nature of the decade that Ted Kennedy drove his car off a bridge at Chappaquiddick while that rocket was on its way to the moon. So terrible ironies in even at that. But one of the images that I have in the book is actually the Apollo 8, which was the first mission that made it to the moon. They didn't land. They just went around it and came back. But they saw, those astronauts saw something that human beings had never seen before, which was an Earthrise. And they took a picture of our fragile blue planet kind of hanging there in space that I think had an enormous philosophical impact,
right.
Had an impact on the environmental movement, but it at least raised the idea more clearly than anything could, maybe, that we have to be in it together. I mean, it's our planet. You know?
I have a minute, less than a minute left, and so I want to hear from an old person like me. What a young person can get out of reading about this decade that so long ago and before many of them were born. What do you hope they take from this book?
I hope they take a sense of the idealism of the time and think about how it can still be preserved and applied to our problems of today. Because that was part of the story, and I hope that's the part that stays with them.
And this was a time when America could do anything. We had built interstate highway system. We were making advances in civil rights. We were making advances around the world with peace in terms of the Peace Corps. We put men on the moon. There were scientific. We could do anything, and we need to recapture that feeling. Maybe we can do that by reading your book. I don't know. Fry Gallard, A Hard Rain, America in the 1960s, Our Lost Decade of Hope, Possibility, and Innocence Lost. Thanks for being here. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.